KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I think we're on the way to getting peace. I think President Putin wants peace, and President Zelensky wants peace, and I want peace. I just want to see people stop getting killed.
As President Trump speaks with Russian President Putin and Ukrainian President Zelensky in separate phone calls, is this the beginning of the end of the war on Ukraine? We'll speak with the nation's Katrina Vandenhoevel. Then Elon Musk's business empire scores benefits under Trump shakeup with little to no oversight or transparency.
So all of our actions are maximally transparent. In fact, I don't think there's been, I don't know of a case that where an organization has been more transparent than the DOGE organization.
We'll speak with three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Eric Lipton about the billions Musk has to gain as he fires thousands and slashes the federal budget. We'll also speak with Lipton about how early crypto traders had speedy profit on Trump coin as others suffered losses, and his story on what to know about the Trump family's deals in the Middle East. Finally, as Indian Prime Minister Modi meets with President Trump at the White House today, we'll speak with the acclaimed Indian writer Pankaj Mishra about India, Israel, and Palestine, his new book, The World After Gaza, A History. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, an agreement has been reached for the ceasefire deal to continue. After talks in Cairo, Hamas announced it'll free three more Israeli hostages Saturday. Israel had threatened to return to, quote, intense fighting if the hostages were not freed as scheduled. In a statement, Hamas said an agreement was reached on, quote, securing housing for our people and urgently bringing in prefabricated houses, caravans, tents, heavy equipment, medical supplies, fuel, and the continued flow of relief and everything stipulated in the agreement, unquote. Israel's continuing to escalate its attacks on the occupied West Bank. The Israeli raids have displaced more than 40,000 Palestinians in Jenin, Tulkarm, Nur Shams, and Al-Farah in recent weeks. In Tulkarm, Al Jazeera reports 85% of the population has been displaced. Earlier today, Israeli forces shot dead a Palestinian man at an Israeli checkpoint south of Nablus. Israel also launched a drone strike on Jenin. Meanwhile, Palestinians have begun to clear rubble in the Al-Farah refugee camp after Israeli troops pulled out of the area.
This refugee camp is targeted just like other refugee camps, and they want to plant the idea that you have to leave. It is obvious that they're trying to reduce the number of people in the camps or empty them, and they are trying, and everybody knows that, to end the case of refugees completely.
The BBC is reporting Israel's again attempting to push back its withdrawal from southern Lebanon until at least February 28th. This comes as the Israeli broadcaster Khan reports Israel's begun building five strategic outposts in the area and a sign Israel may try to keep a long-term presence in southern Lebanon. The newly formed Lebanese government has vowed to restore Lebanon's territorial sovereignty. In other news from the region, the Wall Street Journal has revealed U.S. intelligence agencies believe Israel's considering launching a major attack on Iranian nuclear sites this year. The finding was made by the Biden administration shortly before President Trump took office. The Journal reports the intelligence analysis concluded Israel would push the Trump administration to back the strikes. President Trump spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin for 90 minutes Wednesday. Trump said they agreed to soon meet and immediately begin negotiations to end the war in Ukraine. Trump then held a separate call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. This came as U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth spoke in Brussels, where he said a return to Ukraine's pre-war borders in 2014 is unrealistic. Hegseth also ruled out Ukraine's future membership in NATO. In response, Germany and other European nations criticized the U.S. for granting Russia major concessions before peace talks have even started. Meanwhile, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has traveled to Kyiv to discuss a Trump proposal for Ukraine to give the U.S. access to its natural resources in exchange for continued U.S. military assistance. The Trump-Putin call came after Russia freed the American teacher Mark Fogel in exchange for a Russian jailed for cyber crimes. Belarus has also released three prisoners, including an American and a journalist who works at the U.S.-funded Radio Free Europe. The U.S. Senate confirmed Tulsi Gabbard as Director of National Intelligence. Mitch McConnell was the only Republican to oppose her confirmation. Democrats opposed Gabbard over what one senator called her, quote, bizarre fondness for foreign despots, unquote, citing her 2017 meeting with Syria's then leader Bashar al-Assad and past comments blaming NATO for Russia's war on Ukraine. Following her swearing in Wednesday evening, Tulsi Gabbard met with India's Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who is in Washington to meet with President Trump today. Also on Wednesday, the Senate advanced Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s nomination for health secretary with a final vote expected today. Trump's pick for education secretary, Linda McMahon, the former CEO of World Wrestling Entertainment, is appearing before a Senate panel today. Trump's repeatedly threatened to close the Department of Education, calling it a big con job. On Wednesday, members of the National Education Association and the American Federation of Teachers rallied in front of the Capitol. They were joined by Senator Bernie Sanders.
We are not going to let them to destroy the Department of Education. Department of Education provides funding for 26 million kids who are living in high poverty areas all over this country. And we have the radical idea that maybe poor kids deserve the same quality education that rich kids do.
On Wednesday, federal prosecutors reportedly dropped a probe into Linda McMahon's estranged husband, Vince McMahon, over the cover-up of sexual assault allegations at the WWE. Meanwhile, CNN reports scores of probationary workers have been fired at the Education Department and the Small Business Administration since Friday. Eight inspectors general fired by Trump last month filed a lawsuit arguing their dismissals were unlawful and unjustified. Federal law requires the president give Congress 30 days notice and provide a substantive rationale before firing Senate-confirmed watchdogs. This comes as a federal judge Wednesday lifted a freeze on Trump's buyout offer for government workers, part of a plan by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency to drastically slash the federal workforce. Some 75,000 workers have accepted the buyout so far. Earlier in the day, the newly created DOGE subcommittee held its first meeting, chaired by Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene. The Democratic Congressmember Melanie Stansbury called on Elon Musk to testify before the panel as she blasted Republicans for giving him free rein to dismantle government agencies.
Inflation is going up. You want to raise the debt ceiling by $4 trillion. You want to gut Medicare. You want to gut Medicaid. You're talking about going after Social Security after promising that you wouldn't. I mean, really, what the heck is going on here? We're not trying to take down Elon Musk as a businessman. This dude is literally breaking the law inside of the federal government. And for a party that is supposed to be the party of law and order, in quotes, I really do not see you holding him accountable and doing your most basic constitutional responsibility in the separation of powers.
In related news, DropSite News is reporting the Department of Government Efficiency has gained access to the financial management system used by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and is attempting to withdraw federal funding that has already been appropriated by Congress. Separately, DropSite News reported Wednesday, armored Cybertrucks made by Elon Musk's company Tesla are expected to win a State Department contract worth $400 million. House Republicans Wednesday unveiled a draft budget proposing $4.5 trillion in tax cuts. And at least $1.5 trillion in spending cuts, including cuts to Medicaid and food assistance programs. The plan would also add some $3 trillion to the deficit over a decade and raise the debt limit by $4 trillion. Senator Elizabeth Warren accused Republicans of, quote, pulling a fast one on working people, adding, quote, make no mistake, this GOP plan will raise the costs that American families pay for groceries, health care, and getting an education, all to fund tax cuts for the ultra rich. Warren said. The Justice Department is suing New York Governor Kathy Hochul and Attorney General Letitia James over state policies that says interfere with Trump's crackdown on immigrant communities, including a New York law allowing undocumented New Yorkers to obtain driver's licenses. The DOJ already launched a similar suit against Illinois. New York Attorney General James responded to the lawsuit, quote, saying, our state laws, including the green light law, protect the rights of all New Yorkers and keep our communities safe. I'm prepared to defend our laws, she said. In more immigration news, the New York Times reports at least 53 immigrants deported to Guantanamo by the Trump administration are being guarded by military troops rather than civilian officers. The Trump administration's freeze on foreign aid has led to its first reported death after a 71-year-old Burmese refugee was sent home from a hospital on the Thai-Burma border that was funded by the U.S. through the International Rescue Committee. As the hospital closed, Pekha Lau lost access to a life-sustaining oxygen tank. This is her son-in-law.
Every patient was sent back home after the clinic closed down at the camp. Not only my mother-in-law, every patient went back home. Nobody was left there. My mother-in-law was not in critical condition when she returned home. I'm sure nothing would have happened if she still had an oxygen tank. She died due to the lack of oxygen tanks in the camp.
Other unidentified victims have also reportedly died after health facilities serving refugees from Burma were shuttered. The halting of U.S. aid has also compounded the already dire humanitarian crisis in Haiti, hitting a program that provides treatment to AIDS patients, including pregnant mothers, which has been put on hold despite coming under a waiver that should have exempted it. The Trump administration freeze also halted over $13 million in U.S. funding for an international security force in Haiti attempting to curb gang violence. Meanwhile, new report by Amnesty International finds worsening gang violence had led to severe and widespread abuses against children, including recruitment, rape, abductions, and killings. Amnesty said children with disabilities are particularly vulnerable. Romania's Klaus Iohannis resigned as president this week ahead of an impeachment vote over his decision to stay in power after presidential elections were delayed last December. The election was annulled by Romania's top court, citing Russian state meddling and pushed to May. Weeks earlier, the ultra-nationalist Calin Georgescu shocked pollsters as he came in with the highest share of votes, sending him to an election runoff. The family of Sonia Massey, a black woman who was fatally shot in her kitchen by a sheriff's deputy, has been awarded a $10 million settlement by Sangamon County in Illinois. Massey had called 911 because she was concerned over a potential prowler. Police, public health officials in West Texas have identified at least 22 cases of measles in a county with one of the highest rates of vaccine exemptions in the state. The cases appear to be clustered around private religious schools. Meanwhile, Nevada has confirmed its first human case of bird flu after a dairy worker became infected with a new strain of the H5N1 virus, which has been found circulating among wild birds. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has changed the name of Camp Liberty in North Carolina back to Fort Bragg, but there's a catch. Fort Bragg was originally named after a Confederate slave-owning general. In order to get around a law prohibiting naming bases after Confederate leaders, Hegseth renamed the base after an obscure World War II soldier with the last name of Bragg who didn't even have a Wikipedia page until this week. Meanwhile, more than 50 middle school students at a U.S. military base in Stuttgart, Germany, staged a school walkout during a visit by Hegseth to protest the Trump administration's rollback of diversity initiatives. and the new Trump-appointed board of the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts voted yes on Wednesday to make President Trump its chair, less than a week after he announced plans to take over the famed cultural institution. The board also voted to terminate President Deborah Rutter and replace her with former acting director of national intelligence, Richard Grenell. Following the news, powerhouse TV producer Shonda Rhimes resigned from the Kennedy Center's board, while musician Ben Folds stepped down from his role as artistic advisor to the National Symphony Orchestra. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show with Russia and Ukraine. On Wednesday, President Trump spoke by phone with Russian President Vladimir Putin for 90 minutes about ending the war in Ukraine. Trump said they agreed to meet soon and immediately to begin negotiations to end the war. Trump then held a separate call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. After the swearing-in ceremony for the new director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, Trump spoke to reporters in the Oval Office.
I'll be dealing with President Putin largely on the phone, and we ultimately expect to meet. In fact, we expect that he'll come here and I'll go there, and we're going to meet also probably in Saudi Arabia. The first time we'll meet in Saudi Arabia, see if we can get something done. But we want to end that war. That war is a disaster. It's a really bloody, horrible war.
President Trump also addressed questions from reporters about whether Ukraine was being sidelined.
Why is freezing out President Zelensky of this process a bit? Isn't there a danger of that?
No, I don't think so, as long as he's there. But, you know, at some point you're going to have elections, too. You're going to have an election.
He says he wants security assurances, Mr. President. What does that look like?
In terms of what?
If the war were to end, he says he wants guarantees of security.
We'll see what that means. I think when the war ends, one thing he was very strong about, he wants it to end. And that's President Putin said that. He wants it to end. He doesn't want to end it and then go back to fighting 6 months later. We talked about the possibility, I mentioned it, of a ceasefire so we can stop the killing. And I think we'll probably end up at some point getting a ceasefire in the not too distant future.
Do you view Ukraine as an equal member of this peace process?
It's an interesting question. I think they have to make peace. Their people are being killed, and I think they have to make peace.
President Trump's phone call with Putin came as U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth spoke at a NATO meeting in Brussels, where he said a return to Ukraine's pre-war borders is, quote, unrealistic. Hegseth also ruled out Ukraine's future membership in NATO.
As the war approaches its third anniversary, our message is clear. The bloodshed must stop, and this war must end. We want, like you, a sovereign and prosperous Ukraine. But we must start by recognizing that returning to Ukraine's pre-2014 borders is an unrealistic objective. Chasing this illusionary goal will only prolong the war and cause more suffering. That said, the United States does not believe that NATO membership for Ukraine is a realistic outcome of a negotiated settlement. Instead, any security guarantee must be backed by capable European and non-European troops. If these troops are deployed as peacekeepers to Ukraine at any point, they should be deployed as part of a non-NATO mission. To be clear, as part of any security guarantee, there will not be U.S. troops deployed to Ukraine.
This comes as Germany and other European nations have rejected any peace talks with Moscow that do not include Kyiv. Meanwhile, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has traveled to Kyiv to discuss a Trump proposal for Ukraine to give the U.S. access to its natural resources in exchange for continued U.S. military assistance. According to the State Department, Trump's envoy to Russia and Ukraine, Keith Kellogg, will travel to Germany and Ukraine in the coming days to, quote, engage with allies and partners across Europe who are willing to work with the United States to end Russia's war against Ukraine, unquote. For more, we're joined by Katrina VandenHeuvel, Russia expert and publisher of The Nation magazine. Massive developments in this last 24 hours, Katrina. Is this the beginning of the end of the war in Ukraine? And can you talk about the significance of Trump's call, 90 minutes with President Putin, his first, at least we know publicly, with him since he became president? Also spoke with Zelensky and says first talks will be Russia and the United States in Saudi Arabia.
This is a monumental shift, Amy. Let's begin with the fact that Russia launched this war of aggression. But from there on, this is a monumental shift that, for example, the U.S. is not going to back Ukraine going into NATO. I think the defense secretary saying that has laid down a line that is in opposition to what we've seen for the last 17 years. That's huge. I think the fact that the sides are talking is critical, because for too long it's been a militarized relationship. It's all been about Zelensky's weapons and then the Russian weapons. Both countries are war weary. The soldiers are demoralized. You're entering a period of mud and coming out of the winter. I do think the key will be the security apparatus or the security framework that will be discussed. The Europeans, Macron the other day called for 150,000 security forces or peacekeeping forces. That seems very unrealistic. I think a lot will depend on what kind of security architecture emerges to keep Ukraine sovereign free. There are elections that will be held, and that is mandated by the Ukrainian Constitution, and Zelensky has declared martial law. But in the end, what we're witnessing is, and listen, I mean, Trump, I don't need to tell you how I feel about Trump, how the nation feels about Trump, but there is an importance in what he is beginning to do, which is open up a process to end a war, to move towards ceasefire. And I think that is to be welcomed, because the war is impoverishing Ukraine. The question also will be, with a country, Ukraine, that has some of the vast reserves of titanium and uranium, how those will be allocated to reconstruct a ravaged country, Ukraine, what role Russia will play. There are many, many questions, but the important thing is to get to a table, round, square, oval, and to begin to discuss, talk, 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 jaw, jaw, jaw.
And Katrina, if you could say, you know, these comments that Hegseth made and that Trump has reiterated, namely that, as you mentioned, that NATO membership for Ukraine is ruled out, also that a return to pre-2014 borders is not realistic. So insofar as what we know of Ukraine's demands, is there any likelihood within the negotiations, given what's already been said, that concessions can be made?
Yeah, I mean, I think the membership in the EU, which triggered this crisis in 2014, could be put back on the table. That's a one element. I do think that the reconstruction, the role Russia may play in helping fund reconstruction, is something important. I do think that Crimea and elements of the Donbas region may be put sort of de jure free, but possibly also negotiated into. That's very tricky, the border there, the contact line. We may see a kind of armistice situation that we saw after the Korean War. So it's left there. The trick is not to leave situations on the ground that can re-trigger conflict. The NATO issue, I think, is critical, because I don't know if people know, but it is basically a military-industrial complex lobbying operation. Members of NATO have to buy U.S. weapons. There's an interoperability clause. In the same way, these security conferences that Hegseth is at or was going to, these are military-industrial complex lobbying parties. So again, I come back to the fact, as much as can be demilitarized in the future regarding the security architecture of Ukraine, will be helpful and important for the future of the region. I know there's a narrative that if let alone, Russia will go into the Baltics, will ravage Europe. Russia could barely beat Ukraine, a small country. It's an anguish and horrible to watch what's happened, launched by Russia. We're 3 years on the anniversary. But the ability to talk and find a resolution, I think, can mitigate some of the fears of countries, which really have played a role in the debate to the exclusion of those who argue that Russia is not an expansionist power. I know that will lead many to shriek, but it can barely take on Ukraine. It can't pay the pensions of thousands of people in other countries.
Well, absolutely, Katrina, but how then would you imagine that Russia could play a role somehow in the reconstruction of Ukraine, given its circumstances?
Well, there's a term that we've all learned in the last weeks, oligarchs. I mean, there's a lot of money in Russia that could be used, but the extractive foreign policy of Donald Trump is well suited for this moment because, again, the minerals which Mr. Zelensky has offered as part of a reconstruction effort. They've already had, Penny Pritzker was the reconstruction czar, Governor Pritzker's sister, and she brought in Blackstone, BlackRock, our oligarchs, to help fund the reconstruction. The World Bank estimates it's going to be at least $1 trillion. And we know what happens when countries walk away. We've walked away from Afghanistan. We walked away from other countries. So I think there's a moral and political and security need to find resources for reconstruction.
Can you comment on the prisoner exchange? The teacher, Vogel, American teacher, after 3.5 years in prison in Russia being returned, in exchange for Alexander Vinnik, a cryptocurrency guy who was convicted. He's going back to Russia. And then you've got Belarus involved with 3 prisoners released, one of them American, one of them working for an American media outlet. And also the sort of passing references to Saudi Arabia being involved with that, not to mention it being the place where Trump will meet with Putin for the first part of the negotiation with over the ending of the war in Ukraine, though European countries are saying they wouldn't negotiate unless Ukraine was involved from the beginning.
So the first question, Amy, this is classic Cold War tit for tat. It's like the film Bridge of Spies. I mean, it's exchange of prisoners has been a long time scenario. We've seen it. And I, you know, what also happens seriously is obviously the repression of journalists, the arrest of journalists, the foreign agent, all of this. War is not good for progressive dissenting people. I mean, it used to be said you went on, became a dissident when you went on pension, but I think the dissenting community of Russia has been suppressed, not simply by the war, but by Putin's politics. Saudi Arabia, I gasped when I heard that they might meet in Saudi Arabia, the home of the oligarchical vision. I suspect they'll do Moscow, Washington in the end. But, you know, it reminds of how this war could have been averted. It could have been ended in March, April 2022, when there were substantive discussions in Istanbul. And there's been denial, but there's also been acknowledgement that Victoria Nuland, who was in the State Department, and Boris Johnson, who's Boris Johnson, came in and upended it, sabotaged the possibility back then. So they should take that to their grave.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, we thank you so much for being with us, publisher of The Nation magazine. Next up, Elon Musk's business empire scores benefits under Trump shakeup. We'll speak with 3-time Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter Eric Lipton about the billions Musk has to gain as he fires thousands and slashes the federal budget. Back in 30 seconds. Maybe the dog never comes to light. Shine as bright, greet it right. Though we will fall, but we always lose. Tied my shoes ready. We talk the same, dress for fame. What a fool else believes in us the same.
didn't have to climb twice as high for
the even by Rachel Chinnaruidi and Kat Burns. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Dropsite News has revealed that procurement plans from the State Department include some $400 million to buy new Tesla armored Cybertrucks. This comes as Tesla owner and the world's richest man, Elon Musk, is already one of the biggest beneficiaries of U.S. government contracts and is now also the head of the newly created Department of Government Efficiency, tasked with slashing the federal budget and firing thousands. On Wednesday, the newly created House DOGE subcommittee held its first meeting, chaired by Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene. Elon Musk did not testify as Democrats blasted Republicans for giving him free rein to dismantle government agencies. This is Democratic Congressmember Robert Garcia.
This entire plan is about hurting the American social safety net and destroying our institutions. And it's important that we actually call out what is happening at this subcommittee. This is not about working with the richest man on the planet. This is actually about empowering. This committee wants to empower the richest person in the world to hurt people so they can take all of this money that they so-called want to save and then give it to themselves, their companies, and their billionaire friends.
Congressional Democrats have also called on officials to, quote, uphold federal ethics laws in relation to Elon Musk's role as a special government employee. On Tuesday, Elon Musk spoke to reporters from the Oval Office, standing alongside President Trump, who remains seated at the Resolute desk. It was the first time Musk took questions about his DOGE operation.
Mr. Musk, the White House says that you will identify and excuse yourself from any conflicts of interest that you may have. Does that mean that you are, in effect, policing yourself? What are the checks and balances that are in place to ensure that there is accountability and transparency?
Well, we actually are trying to be as transparent as possible. In fact, our actions, we post our actions to the DOGE handle on X and to the DOGE website. So all of our actions are maximally transparent. In fact, I don't think there's been, I don't know of a case that where an organization has been more transparent than the DOGE organization.
For more, we're joined by Eric Lipton, three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, investigative reporter at the New York Times, part of a team investigating Elon Musk's business with the federal government. His latest piece, Elon Musk's Business Empire Scores Benefits Under Trump Shakeup. Eric, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out the agencies that Elon Musk has gone after, the wealthiest man in the world, and also the fact that these are the very agencies that have been investigating him, whether we're talking about the NLRB or the EEOC, whether we're talking about the FAA or fining him, or talking about the Consumer Protection Board, all of this.
Right. I mean, what we examined was the fact that Elon Musk, as you said, is one of the largest contractors that the federal government has. He's received, over $15 billion worth of contractual obligations from the federal government in the last decade, $3.8 billion just in 2024. The bulk of that comes from the Department of Defense and NASA because he's launching almost everything they put up into orbit, spy satellites, astronauts, cargo, communication satellites, and so... You know, at the same time, he is also the subject of dozens of distinct investigations and lawsuits and complaints that the federal government agencies are handling from, you know, across the landscape. Just about every acronym you can come up with, they've got some investigation of him. So, for example, the Federal Aviation Administration is simultaneously currently examining the recent explosion of the Starship rocket that blew up and sent debris, coming down over the Caribbean last month, and the planes had to get out of the way or else they would have been struck by the falling debris as that rocket blew up. And they're also examining whether or not to allow SpaceX's Starship to launch 25 times a year out of Boca Chica in South Texas near the Mexican border. And they're also, looking at the damage that those launches are having to the wildlife in adjacent National Wildlife Refuge. I was there in June of 2024 during one of the launches and then walked the area nearby and saw, various eggs that were destroyed from threatened species of birds that had been blown up by the debris that was sent out by the rocket, and there was an investigation of that. So all these things are ongoing. So the guy at the same time has, you know, billions of dollars of pending contracts. He's got all of these investigations, and now he's been tasked by Trump to look into the FAA, to look into the Department of Defense. And so that creates, at a minimum, it's an appearance of conflict of interest. And the open question is, what role is he playing in potentially putting restraints on some of the same regulators that are investigating him? And we do not have transparency into that. Despite what he said, it is not a transparent operation. It is incredibly hard to see into it. And we know is that there is this overlap between the things that he interacts with the government on as a private businessman and the things he's doing as a special government employee.
And Eric, could you explain, there's something like 24 ongoing investigations by the National Labor Relations Board into Musk's companies, if you could elaborate on that a little?
Yes. Yeah, so when Musk bought Twitter and was in the process of reducing and or significantly, you know, cutting its staff, there was some criticism of his actions, and there was some allegations by employees there that the company was snooping on employees and mistreating the employees and improperly dismissing the employees, and there were complaints that were filed with the National Labor Relations Board. And there are many complaints. And the NLRB, as it's called, is an entity that Elon Musk does not even think constitutionally should exist. He's sued to try to get rid of it. So the NLRB now has lost its quorum because Trump removed some members of the staff and a member of the board. And so effectively it is now in a static state. So in all of these cases that we examined in more than 10 different federal agencies, we did not find a situation where Musk himself used his power at DOGE to fire or to stop an investigation of himself. But what we did find was that all of the disruption that is happening across the federal government has benefited his operations to the extent that there are investigations that have been stalled, or there are quorums on oversight bodies that are no longer exist, or the chairwoman of the Federal Election Commission, for example, Trump fired, and the FEC was investigating whether or not Musk had made illegal campaign contributions and had an illegal, essentially a lottery or a sweepstakes during the election, giving out $1 million to people who are registering to vote. So that, you know, all of what we found was the overlap between changes that have occurred and investigations that were targeting Musk and his operations.
And explain how it works. How is it possible that he does not have to be investigated or sign off on conflict of interest agreements, that we don't know what these conflicts of interest are, and yet he has this enormous power? People are now calling him the ex-president, not in terms of past, but the letter X.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, normally if you're a federal government employee, you can't have a contract with the federal government. And also, if you're a federal government employee, you are prohibited under criminal law from taking any action that could on a particular matter. So it can't be a general policy, but on a specific matter that directly impacts your family or yourself financially. And that's a criminal offense if you do that. And so a special government employee, which Musk is, means that you are essentially a private person who's not a full-time employee, but you're advising the government, but your role is significant enough that you actually have this status as special government employee. And SGEs, as they're known, are actually subject to the same federal conflict of interest criminal law. So he is prohibited under federal criminal law from taking any action, specific action, that could benefit himself. Now, but there is a waiver process. A waiver can be granted to a person who's a special government employee that effectively allows them to take actions that benefit themselves. We've asked the White House if such a waiver has been granted to him. The answer that we got earlier this week is that Musk is filling out his financial disclosure report, because as a special government employee, you're required to fill out a financial disclosure report, which details all of your financial holdings. And what happens then is the ethics lawyer reviews that document and then evaluates where will your conflict of interest emerge based on your holdings. And then they write up what's called an ethics letter. And the ethics letter says you must recuse from this, 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 and this, or else you will have a conflict of interest. And it's only after the ethics letter exists that typically you get a waiver. So that would suggest he doesn't yet have a waiver because he's just filling out the financial disclosure report. And they also told us that that financial disclosure report is not going to be made public, which is actually allowed under law. If you're a special government employee and you're not paid, it is a confidential financial disclosure report. So that's a long answer for we don't really have a basis of evaluating if he's doing things that violate the conflict of interest law because we don't know what the ethics letter, the limits that it sets, and we can't even evaluate if he's honoring the ethics letter because it doesn't appear as if the ethics letter exists yet.
So, Eric, we want to go to the other reporting that you've done on the Trump meme coin in an article headlined, Early Crypto Traders Had Speedy Profit on Trump Coin as Others Suffered Losses. Could you lay out what you found in that piece?
Yeah, this is an entirely separate line of reporting. It's been an incredibly busy period since Trump went into office, working crazy hours and 7 days a week trying to examine so many different things that are happening simultaneously. But my colleague David Yaffe Bellamy and I have written, you know, three or four articles now about the Trump meme coin, which was introduced on January 17th at 9 p.m. at the same moment that a bunch of cryptocurrency executives were gathering in Washington for what they called the crypto ball. And what we were really particularly interested in on was how was the Trump family profiting from this new cryptocurrency meme coin? And who was making money and who was losing money? And we spent 2 weeks really digging into that while we were working on other stories and trying to gather the data based on examining the blockchain, which records every single transaction, every purchase and every sale, and looking at who the winners and losers were by looking at their wallets. And what we found was that more than 800,000 people that followed Trump's advice lost more than $1 billion. And at the same time, the Trump family and its partners have made more than $100 million in transaction fees. And there are other traders who got in really quickly who know what a meme coin is all about, which is a speculative sort of worthless platform. You know, it has no inherent value. It's just a speculative vehicle. And these really sophisticated traders instantly purchased large amounts of the Trump meme coin. And then they sold it just as the retail traders, the fans of Trump who were sort of, you know, just getting onto their computers and more slowly purchasing them. Those retail buyers became effectively the liquidity for the sophisticated seller that then was selling to them and they were buying those tokens. And so the short answer is that a certain small group of people made enormous profits, but hundreds of thousands of people that followed Trump's advice lost money. And the Trump family is walking away and its partners with more than $100 million simply in fees. And so that's, you know, that it's a, you sort of wonder, you know, who benefited in that situation? And it is not clearly the people that follow Trump.
And finally, Eric, we just have a minute, but another piece that you wrote, what to know about the Trump's family deals in the Middle East?
Yes, busy time. So, yes, we were also examining how the Trump family during the first term sort of limited its new international deals. They're not doing that now. They're doing a bunch of deals with, in particular, a Saudi Arabian company called Dar Al Arkan. They've got a deal in Dubai, in two in Saudi Arabia, one in Oman. And so they are moving full steam ahead on new international deals. And in fact, even in deals, for example, in Serbia, in Belgrade, that the government of Serbia owns the land. So Trump is both setting foreign policy relative to Serbia at the same time as his family is going to be building a hotel on government-owned land. That, you know, that's a conflict of interest right there.
And, of course, there's Ivanka and Jared Kushner in Albania, and Jared Kushner, of course, getting $2 billion from Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, a lot to write about. We are very busy right now, and I hope that you're reading these stories. I mean, you know, accountability matters, but it's important that you take the time to read these stories, that you share these stories. You know, just writing into a vacuum doesn't make a difference.
Eric Lipton, thanks so much for being with us. Three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, investigative reporter at the New York Times. investigating Elon Musk's business with the federal government. We'll link to your latest pieces, including Elon Musk's business empire scores benefits under Trump shakeup. When we come back, Indian Prime Minister Modi meets with President Trump at the White House today. Modi met with Tulsi Gabbard last night, right as she was sworn in as head of national intelligence. We'll speak with the acclaimed Indian writer Pankaj Mishra about India, Israel, and Palestine. His new book, The World After Gaza. Stay with us. Now, who's the real thugs, killers, and gangsters? Set the revolution, let the things bust, and thank us. When the smoke clear and you can see the sky again, there will be the chopped off heads of Leviathan. My friend, we call them strangers. Anybody talk to them, end up in some danger. Can't reform them. They pray four times a day, they pray five. Who weighs the strains when it's time to survive? Some will go of their own free will to die. Others take them with you when they blow sky high. What's the difference? All you get is lost children while the bosses sit up behind the desk. It costs billions to blast humans in half into calves and arms. Only one side is allowed to have bombs. It's like making a soldier drop his weapon, shooting them, and telling them to get to stepping. Obviously, they came to portion strange of strange ways by the legendary man. Villain. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to a new book by the acclaimed Indian author and essayist Pankaj Mishra. In a moment, we'll get to India as Prime Minister Narendra Modi is scheduled to meet with President Trump and members of his administration today. Modi's first meeting upon arriving in Washington Wednesday was with the new Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, who is a Hindu American. But first we go to Gaza, where a deal has been reached for the ceasefire to continue. After talks in Cairo, Hamas has announced it will free three more Israeli hostages on Saturday. Israel had threatened to resume the war on Gaza if the hostages were not freed as scheduled.
For more, we're joined in London by Pankaj Mishra. His latest book, The World After Gaza, A History, which places the latest war since October 7, 2023, in a larger context of Western colonialism. In his prologue to the book, he writes, quote, "He felt almost compelled to write this book to alleviate my demoralizing perplexity before an extensive moral breakdown." Pankaj Mishra is also author of Age of Anger, A History of the Present. From the Ruins of Empire, The Intellectuals Who Remade Asia, and several other books of nonfiction and fiction. He writes regularly for The Guardian and the New York Review of Books, among other publications. Pankaj Mishra, welcome to Democracy Now! It's an honor to have you with us. Why don't you respond to the latest news? The ceasefire apparently will continue after President Trump said all hell will break loose if Hamas doesn't release more hostages on Saturday. And Hamas said the reason they had been holding out was that they said that Israel had broken the ceasefire agreement hundreds of times. Your overall thoughts?
Well, you know, I think the ceasefire remains extremely fragile because there's a new element there injected by a volatile U.S. president who, you know, keeps issuing these threats randomly. You know, I don't know whether he'll be satisfied with the release of just three hostages on Saturday. He might change his mind tomorrow or today. We don't know. So the ceasefire remains, you know, extremely fragile. And I think it's because Trump has now announced his plans for ethnic cleansing Gaza. And I think Hamas or other militant groups have less and less incentive to keep to their side of the deal. And we know that the far-right regime in Israel completely endorses Trump's plan and can't wait to, you know, get it started. So I think we shouldn't be really surprised if the ceasefire breaks down sooner than we can see right now.
So, Pankaj, if you could, let's, you know, go to your book, The World After Gaza, A History, and talk about this assault on Gaza in the context of the history that you lay out. As we said in our introduction, you write in the prologue to the book, quote, that you felt almost compelled to write this book to alleviate my demoralizing perplexity before an extensive moral breakdown. Explain why you wrote that book and how you see the present situation in the context of the history that you lay out.
Well, you know, I think The primary impulse behind the book was really to put an end to this horrible loneliness that I felt, along with many other people, a kind of desolation induced by the fact that, you know, powerful people, powerful politicians in democracies, journalists, intellectuals, were either silent about the, ongoing genocide in Gaza, or even worse, you know, vehemently supporting it. So I think, you know, it forced many of us to re-examining, you know, not just sort of narratives of you know, Middle Eastern history or Israeli history or Palestinian history, but a kind of broader history of Western supremacism, of decolonization. You know, we also saw a massive global divide open up in the responses to the atrocities in Gaza, with South Africa, a country like South Africa, taking the lead in bringing a case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. And of course, we can now see South Africa is being severely punished by Trump and Musk for daring to do this. We saw public opinion in most of the world really shocked and appalled by the disproportionate Israeli response. And at the same time, you know, that public opinion asking questions, you know, of Western democracies, like, what happened here? Why are you supporting this endless massacre of thousands and thousands of people? So, you know, in a very sort of, I think I would say that I find myself in the situation of a lot of people who were completely bewildered by the Israeli response to October 7. And, you know, at least I have this option of turning my anguish or turning my bewilderment into, you know, some way of trying to understand this through writing, through prose. But, you know, it remains a baffling episode. And of course, we're now entering the most intense part of it. You know, you just described, whether it's Ukraine, just been listening to this program now for 45 minutes, and this, you know, vast panorama of violence, disorder, and suffering that we're seeing today. And I think it's really important not just to think about the past or the history, the larger history of what is happening in Gaza today, but also about the present. And that is also something I describe in the book, whether Gaza signifies something more than just the latest episode in a long-standing conflict in the Middle East. Does it portend the, you know, arrival of far-right racial supremacist regimes across the Western world? So I would, you know, I would argue, and I have said this in the book, that we are looking at a far more extensive moral, political, and I would say intellectual breakdown than we have known, certainly in our own lifetimes.
And that perhaps, Pankaj, explains the title of your book, The World After Gaza, which suggests that there's, in your view, some kind of rupture, that the world is somehow substantively different. It will be different after this assault on Gaza ends, in the event that it does, and what form it takes. So if you could say something about that, and then also the point that you made earlier about decolonization. It's a theme that runs throughout the book, in which you say, correctly, I think, that the seminal event of the 20th century for the vast majority of the peoples of the world was decolonization. Why is that significant when we look at what's happened in Gaza and the response to it?
Well, I think very simply, decolonization was not just a political event. It was not just, you know, a whole lot of nation states in Asia and Africa becoming sovereign, becoming liberated from their European masters. It was also a profound emotional and psychological moment of liberation. I think, you know, from the 19th century onwards, the world was knit together by a very explicitly racial mode of imperialism and capitalism. And I think, you know, some of the best people in Asia and Africa fought against this global regime and finally won starting the mid-20th century and created these nation states that you know, exist all across Asia and Africa, and are becoming both politically, economically, and geopolitically more assertive. And there's also, you know, a mental revolution also going on, has been going on for several decades. So I think for many people in the West who have been absorbed with a very different narrative, first of all, the narrative of the Cold War, the narrative of the end of history, the narrative of American unipolar dominance, decolonization still comes as a kind of news, or they confuse it with people asking for decolonizing, you know, knowledge in the United States, or decolonizing educational syllabuses. So I think there's a very broad confusion about this world, but what it really signifies is greater political intellectual assertiveness and a very fierce desire to not live in a world where racial privilege, more specifically white privilege, orders and forces a global hierarchy. You know, you can see this very clearly in sort of South African president a few days ago making a speech and saying, we will not be bullied. You know, Trump is imposing very severe sort of measures against the country. And there they are standing and saying, we're going to push back. And likewise, I think you'll find that kind of resistance in different parts of the world. And of course, you know, what happened in Gaza, which shocked, appalled people, you know, from Indonesia to Brazil. That is also something, you know, that can really only be explained, this global divide, if you think about decolonization creating a new subjectivity, a new mentality, a new way of looking at the world.
And Pankaj, maybe President Trump understands this very well, as he repeated his claim that the U.S. is preparing to take control of Gaza, own it while permanently displacing the territory's entire population of 2 million Palestinians. I wanted to just play that short clip of him sitting next to Jordan's King Abdullah for talks on Gaza at the White House on Tuesday.
We're going to have Gaza. We don't have to buy. There's nothing to buy. We will have Gaza.
What does that mean?
No reason to buy. There is nothing to buy. It's Gaza. It's a war-torn area. We're going to take it.
So there you have President Trump saying, not just we're going to buy it, we're going to own it, we're going to have it. Again, trying to push back on this whole trend, this whole move in the 20th century of decolonization.
Well, you know, this is the strangest thing, really, you know, that the United States is going back, and that is part of the great American unraveling. It's going back to a 19th century model of rapacious imperialism that's interested in territory, that is grabbing resources wherever they can find it. And this, you know, Ukraine deal you were just talking about, that is now so much about resources that Trump has eyed in Ukraine. So I think, you know, this is something that people have been talking about for a very long time, that the structures and mentalities of racial imperialism in the 19th century are very much alive. People like that were dismissed as woke, as politically correct, but we are now seeing a kind of real-time live verification of those insights into the nature of the modern world. And, you know, what Trump is saying today is bringing a very refreshing kind of clarity. We can see how this wealth, how this great power was slowly accumulated, and how people fearing the loss of that power because China is rising, China is becoming dominant, you have the most powerful people in the world resorting to the most naked form of expansion, the most naked forms of appropriation.
Before we go, Pankaj, if you could just comment on the meeting of Modi with Trump today at the White House, and then we'll do an extended conversation.
Well, you know, I think we've seen very recently, just in the last few days, you know, a kind of endless parade of heads of state. Jordan, you just mentioned, the Japanese prime minister was just there. People really trying to appease a bully, the chief bully, and hoping that they will get something out of him that they can go back and share with their people. I think Modi is in a particularly difficult situation. I don't know if your viewers know.
We have 15 seconds.
There were images all across India of you know of Indian migrants being deported from the United States, shackled and chain it, was it created a lot of shock. And Modi has to now go back and tell people that India's dignity is intact, which is a great tall order right now.
Pankaj Mishra, award-winning Indian author, essayist. His new book, The World After Gaza, A History. We'll do part two and post online at Democracy Now!